And in fact, we will get to your calls later on this hour. Won't roll the numbers yet. We've got a little bit to get to still with Mary Roach helping us get caught up on our science knowledge on Coast to Coast. We're talking about packing for Mars, and we'll get to that. Well, I guess some people would call it the controversial part about all that she revealed about people's most prurient questions about those spacesuits. Coming up next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. I'm sure Mary Roach is hard at work on her next book, right?
Yes, that's true.
Do you want to tell us what it's about yet? No.
I'm gonna be coy.
Okay. What if I name a bunch of onomatopoeias? Will you then supply the subject that would go along with them?
Yeah. Okay. And, try me.
We'll do. How about a book called Blurt?
Blurt. Okay.
Blurt.
A history of bad manners and missing inhibition.
Okay. Good. Drip would be a good. That would be a Mary Roach book. Drip.
Yeah. It could. The history of indoor plumbing.
Eek.
Eek. The natural history of mice.
Flick.
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 Flick. Yeah, that one is up on the top shelf behind with a lock and key, I think.
Flick. I like that one. I think that's a potential Mary Roach book someday. So along with Bonk and Stiff and Zoinks and I can't remember all of them, but Packing for Mars from last year, big book, and you did a lot with it. And this part, ended up being a lot of the focus of the interviews was about the spacesuits, but that does address there's been a lot of curiosity about bodily functions in space, and even both from its more fundamental phase from the very beginning to the evolution, the full scientific evolution of the spacesuits today. Where do you want to start?
Let's start back in the Gemini Apollo era, because that was some amazing hardship there. You have no bathroom. You don't even have a toilet. What you have is a bag. And you're up there a few days, even for the moonshots, 2 weeks. You've got it kind of like what you would use to pick up the dog poop when you go out and walk the dog. You know, maybe like the size of a little shorter than the sleeve on your newspaper.
Right. The blue New York Times bag.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Right.
So it's more high tech and considerably more expensive. It's called a fecal bag and a little ring of adhesive that never really quite stuck the way it was supposed to. Very difficult to position. Okay, the other thing to bear in mind here, we are in zero gravity. So you don't have what this is the holy grail of the NASA waste management people. Good separation. You don't have gravity pulling the quote-unquote material, the contributions, if you will, not pulling them away from the body by their own weight. They're just hovering. So it's up to you and a finger cot, the little thing you stick your fingers in, you kind of urge the stuff down into the bag. Anyway, it was the big.
You have to like massage it into the bag.
Then you had to open this little packet, like a soy sauce packet with germicide. Put that in and mush it through the material.
Oh, that's what it was. Oh my God!
Yeah,
yes. I think I blotted that out of my mind after reading the book.
I don't blame you. Yeah. And Jim Lovell was kind enough to talk to me about this. Gemini 7 2-week mission. He said sometimes if I was feeling very hostile toward Frank Borman, I'd hand him the bag with the germicide and say, "Here, Frank, I'm busy. You do it."
Oh God. But it got better.
It did get better. Yeah, when Space Lab, this was the era of the toilet. There was actually a toilet, but not like on Earth, because on Earth, you have water, you have gravity. In space, airflow was what was required to kind of like entrain the contribution.
Right.
You're like a shop vac. You're sitting on a shop vac. It's airflow, and that's pulling it away from the body. And so, so that's what gives you the separation. And that's the problem, though, was it, you know, the body of the toilet was kind of exposed to the vacuum of space, which would freeze the stuff, which, you know, cut down on the bacteria, and that was, it was a good thing. But stuff kind of tended to bounce around in there, like kind of like a popcorn popper, because you have the airflow and you've got some hard, you know, material that's bouncing around. They actually have a name for this phenomenon, fecal popcorning, it was called.
Really? Who called it that?
The waste management engineer that I interviewed.
Wow.
Yeah,
okay.
Fecal popcorning. And the problem is that when you float up off the seat, sometimes if you're not careful, the little popcorning particle could escape. And then you have what's known, again, technical term, an escapee. You just don't want an escapee. Is that, you know, it's floating. It's floating. It's flying around with you. There were these moments in the... going back to Apollo, they had escapees from the bags, too, and just these hysterical moments where somebody will be having a conversation like, well, yeah, and about 12:43, we're going to have a 627. Whose is that?
Oh, escapee.
Stickier. You know, just these moments where, yeah, they had a really good sense of humor about it, those guys, because really, it was like living in a latrine.
Yeah, really. Now, but now, is there some level of privacy now, or is it everybody's business?
Now, when you go to the loo or the john, you've got a curtain that you can pull. So you do have privacy. You're not in the same situation when you were in the capsule, where you're essentially sitting on a love seat with the guy. And you got to drop your drawers and do the thing with the bag, which, you know, you talk about getting to know somebody really fast.
Really? Well, you know, maybe that's where all of the military training really comes in handy at that point, because you've probably been through that for years. It's probably a little less true now with fewer people, you know, sort of proud military people and more academics that are going into space.
Right. That was one. There were a number of things that made Air Force folks, military folks, good picks for the space program, not just the fact that they could fly space, you know, aircraft, but they are used to long periods of time apart from their family, small space, not very much privacy, just, you know, just stripping down in front of other, I mean, it was just, they were used to all of that. It wasn't quite perhaps the hardship it might have been, or the adjustment that it might have been for someone else.
And as far as the sort of the bodily functions concerned, even something as simple as odor management or nausea management requires what, the same waste science that goes into it?
Well, with motion sickness, when you're zero gravity, does a number on you in terms of nausea, because your the little bones in your inner ear are now floating and not resting on the bottom of the inner ear chamber, and that just does a number on you. Most astronauts will have some a couple of days of adjustment where they're really feeling crummy and possibly throwing up. And this is a big concern when you're in a spacesuit. If you're going to do a spacewalk, imagine you've got that big bulky suit and a helmet, so you can't grab a vomit bag and hold it to your face. So if you throw up, you're throwing up in the helmet. And there was a real concern that the stuff would kind of cling to your face and you would suffocate. In fact, the folks who designed the suits thought this through very carefully. There's airflow that comes down over the forehead, would sort of push the stuff down into the suit, which is revolting but not life-threatening.
Right.
But it is dangerous in that you would have visor splatter. This was, and believe me, this has been simulated on Earth. They've simmed this scenario.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Because if you were disoriented because you couldn't see out of your visor, that's a dangerous thing when you're out onto the outside of the spacecraft, zipping around the Earth at 17,000 miles per hour. You don't want to lose your way.
No. And it's so amazing that they actually did tests on how to recover from an internal helmet vomiting event. Right.
I mean, this is what everything has been thought through and simulated. Here on Earth, it really is extraordinary. But they had a situation. It wasn't. It was an Apollo. I forget which Apollo it was now. Forgive me, but it was. It was Charlie Duke, and he had the little in-suit drink bag. They have a little thing you can near the mouth. When you're in a spacesuit, a pressure suit, you can drink while you have the helmet on, and they put Tang in there for a while, and his was leaking. And so the poor guy, he's like, this is the high point of his career, of his life. He's on the moon, and yet there's just Tang all through his hair. It's all over his visor. At one point, he's looking in the distance. There's these two craters named Wreck and Trap. He says, this is in the transcript. He says, yeah, I can see Wreck and Trap and orange juice.
Oh!
It's all over his visor, his hair.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
But then, I mean, since you're living in your own suit, that means you're kind of living in your own stink, in the sense that you're not getting any showers. So what did they do to compensate for that? We're talking with Mary Roach, packing for Mars, about all aspects of how we would prepare ourselves, how people have been prepared historically for space travel. And so how do they do that? Are there special little, are there like little sprays that would go into the suit, or a way to freshen the suit?
The suit is something that you put on only when you're on a spacewalk. So when you're in, say, the shuttle or the International Space Station, you're just wearing a polo shirt and some sweatpants or whatever, your shorts, whatever. So it's only when you're outside those are maybe 6 hours at the most, I believe, the spacewalks. So you've got the diaper, the pull-up diaper, in case you have some sort of an emergency, if you can't hold it. And I'm told they rarely use the diaper. It's just peace of mind.
Right.
So, but I did ask somebody, if you fart in a spacesuit, what happens? He says, well, there's a very elaborate air circulation system. But I forget which person told me this, but he said, yeah, it comes around a few times.
Before it cycled out.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, God.
There's actually activated charcoal, which absorbs some of the sulfur smell. So, but it takes a little while.
Only because you mentioned Jim Lovell and Frank Borman. It reminded me that they were the ones they were the most prominent and the most vocal about seeing UFOs in space when they were in the Gemini launch, December 1965. James Lovell and Frank Borman report back to Houston seeing a UFO during their second orbit of their record-breaking 14-day flight. They were told that was not, in fact, a UFO, but it was the final stage of their own Titan booster rocket. Frank Borman confirmed to ground control that he could see the booster rocket all right, but that wasn't what they were looking at, something else completely different. And that same thing with a pilot from 62, Robert White, reported one during his 58-mile-high flight of X-15. And then Joseph Walker said that was actually one of his tasks when he went up in 1962 on an X-15 flight, was to count how many he could see. He counted 6 UFOs when he went up.
Good heavens.
I know. I just think that's so fascinating. And apparently there's film of this that has never been released. Even Eugene Cernan, commander of Apollo 17, in an LA Times article in 1973, he said, I thought they were something else, some other civilization of what he saw.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I just look at that and I think, well, that's like this whole aspect of this that I would have thought would have come up in training. They would have tried to say, okay, don't get freaked out if you're going up into space and you see something like this. Because I know I'd have my nose pressed against the glass and I would blow the rest of the mission because I would just be talking about having seen a UFO in space.
You know, there's a book that came out on the anniversary of Apollo 11, I think it was this past year, called Rocket Man, and one of the things that somebody told him, yanking his chain, was that the reason that the visors were gold was so that if an alien came up to you, that he would see his reflection and be scared and run away. And he put that in the book, not realizing, I guess, that it was a joke. But
right.
I just love the, I was trying to picture the NASA meeting where they go, I know, let's make it reflective, because those aliens are really ugly, and when they see themselves for the first time, they go,
they'll freak out. I've always wanted to add, so that, like, a lot of people want to know about the bodily function stuff, and that's probably a question that you got a lot too when you were touring for Packing for Mars.
Yes.
Here's my number one question, because this is what would determine whether or not how anxious I would be about trying to become an astronaut, is do they actually give you weapons in space? Are you allowed to have, like, an X-ray gun, or are there any weapons at all when tell me about that.
There was the cosmonauts. After Alexei Leonov's first flight, they carried a pistolette. Now, remember, if you're launching stuff, you want it to be lighter. So it was like a ladies. It was like a pistolette. It was a little bit fey, maybe. But but interestingly, it was not for aliens. It was because when they came down, it was a capsule landing on land. And it was often, you know, in the Kazakh steppe, and sometimes it would land a little bit off course. And Alexei Leonov's capsule landed in the woods, and there were wolves. And they...
Wow.
Yeah, they were like, what do we do? We've got no way. We could throw our helmets at them. You know,
yeah.
We don't have anything. So that's
wolf
why...
Wolf protection.
What?
Wolf protection.
Wolf protection. It was a survival, part of the survival gear for the landing. But people have since said, that if Alexei Leonov, during his spacewalk, if something were to happen with him, the gun was for the other guy to shoot him. But that's not the case, because if something happens to him, he's just going to asphyxiate, and he's going to lose consciousness pretty quickly. And that's a pretty quick and painless way to go, from what I understand. And
in space, right.
Yeah, and the gun was actually not for putting a racehorse out of its misery, but that's one of the rumors, was that that's why they had the gun. I don't know that there is still they still carry a gun or not on the Soyuz. That I don't know.
Other than the tragedies of American space travel, nobody has died in space, have they?
No, just the Challenger, the Columbia. There was a depressurization accident that caused the cosmonauts on one of the missions.
So, on reentry.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So those guys were dead in the capsule. And there was the fire, Apollo 1.
Of course.
And those guys burned to death. But... you know, that's an interesting issue, and that's something that recently, when I wrote Stiff, I was in touch with this woman who came up with a very elaborate freeze drying and composting method for human remains. She's worked with NASA to come up with this system. It's all theory; it's not in practice. But because they were thinking about for a Mars mission, when we were still more actively talking about a Mars mission, what if someone dies on the way there or back? What do you do with the body? You can't just have it on board deteriorating.
No.
Do you put it in the airlock and give it a nudge?
Oh, yeah.
Could do that, but then the family probably would want the remains. So
no.
she came up with this elaborate system. It's this robotic arm that would carry the body out into space, and it would just like a freeze dry it, and then it was a very elaborate thing. Then you would like tether it, and you bring it back in before reentry so it wouldn't burn up, and you could then present it to the family.
Jettison me into space, I say. Send me into an eternal orbit around Earth. I think that'd be fascinating. I think they should all agree to that before they get in the capsule. They should all be signed on to what would happen. I think that'd be the best way to do it. We're talking with Mary Roach, author of Packing for Mars, and also Stiff, and Spook, and Bonk. And we'll get to your questions for Mary Roach. You can link up to her, too, through coasttocoastam.com. Get any of these great books. They're all fun reading, and it will help us get caught up in our science knowledge here in the United States with all the other countries that we're supposed to feel really, really terrible about being behind. And we'll get to your questions and comments for Mary Roach, too. And the top of the hour, Rick Collingwood, internationally recognized expert on hypnotism, coming up on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Yeah, we are marching to Mars with Mary Roach taking a couple of your science questions coming up next on Coast to Coast. Then coming up on Sunday night, we'll take you inside the secret world of offshore banking, money laundering, and the government involvement of all of these nefarious activities, both in the Caribbean and in Europe. Who knows what's really going on? And what can you and can't you get away with when it comes to offshore banking and money laundering? How deep is the CIA in all of this, too? Coming up tomorrow night on Coast to Coast. I'll be in on Sunday night. And we'll get to your questions and comments for Mary Roach for this half hour next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Mary Roach, the author of Stiff, Spook, Bonk, and Packing for Mars. You can find out more about her at coasttocoastam.com. I have some other onomatopoeias, though, that I want to ask you. What would be the Mary Roach book to the title Thump?
Thump is the definitive history of the WWF.
That's excellent. I like that. Whack? What would be the?
Let's see. Whack. The anonymous book about the mafia. Tell all. A mafia tell all.
How about Yikes?
Yikes. The inventor of the roller coaster. His personal story.
I like that. Anyway, you can link up to Mary Roach at Coast to Coast. AM.com and pick up copies of her book, Great for Christmas, including Packing for Mars. Let's get to Bob in Miami on Coast to Coast for Mary Roach. Go ahead, Bob.
How you doing, Ian? How you doing, Mary?
Hi, Bob.
Okay. I saw an article about an experiment at a Cornell University, and they have these magnets, and they had this electron beam, and this beam got up to 200 million degrees. Now, they contained this 200 million degrees in a magnetic bottle. Now, for theory's sake, let's just say that we can attach this to the back of a space shuttle. I know none of the magnets are huge. I understand that. But just for theory's sake, okay, you attach it to the back of the space shuttle, and you get the 200 million degrees contained in a magnetic bottle. And you open up the magnet bottle, what would happen to the space shuttle?
I don't know.
What
did it say in the article, Bob?
What now?
What did it say in the article?
Was this supposed to...
Okay, it says that the 200 million degrees was contained by a magnetic bottle.
Okay.
Were they trying to come up with a new kind of rocket propulsion?
No. A new energy source, like a power plant or something like that, and they didn't get enough energy out of it. But I went, wait a minute. Well, what happened? What would happen if you had it attached to the space shuttle? You open that bottle up, 200 million degrees. That's a lot of energy, right?
Yeah.
I'm just wondering how come the glass doesn't melt.
Yeah, really.
That's some kind of fancy glass. That's like better than the that stuff that you can put in the oven.
Let's get to Larry in Reno, west of the Rockies, on Coast to Coast for Mary Roach. Larry?
Yeah, hi, Mary. Just a question about maybe you could address the differences between the launching of a John Glenn in comparison to today's launches with the space shuttle and the maybe the material that was used on the capsule with Glenn as opposed to that, the tiles they use on the space shuttle. And one other thing, I remember some source I read years ago that it said that when John Glenn, under those circumstances of being shot up into space, that his blood pressure and or heart rate didn't deviate one point. Is you know anything about that?
Oh, that's it sounds like it's apocryphal, but yeah, that's interesting. Go ahead.
Well, the heart rate and blood pressure. I remember hearing something about that he was just. I mean, one of them fell asleep waiting for the launch. I mean, those guys were just unfazed. The other thing about the launches is that they. They did such a good job of simulating what they were going to go through with the extra G's, the vibration, the noise. They had gone through it in simulation so many times that it almost just felt like another day in the weird little metal capsule. But, you know, they'd been so well trained that you really could believe that they would fall asleep. I mean, obviously,
right.
a little extreme, but that, you know, that was something. And they did that with the chimps that went up before them too. That's when people often say, well, you're like, oh my God, that must have been so frightening for the animal. But they had experienced it all in simulation so many times that it probably wasn't that different.
Yeah.
For them,
if they just taken a chimp out of the wild and stuck it in a suit and a capsule, that would have been really cruel. But
right.
But what about the exteriors? Yeah, I guess we sort of take that end of the science for granted, but it does seem odd that we're still putting tiles on the exterior of something. It sounds like a DIY project.
Well,
you know.
as long as the tiles stay on, I mean, they're pretty, you know, high-tech protective material, but when they, when they're coming off,
Well, that's the thing. They say every time there's like a certain number of tiles will come off every time. And I'm thinking, really? They can't.
Can you get a better grout?
You can't. Exactly. Is this really, like, can we bring in Bob Vila on this to take care of this?
Exactly. The hardware, rocket hardware, I didn't really cover.
Right.
I'm the human software.
Aspect of it. Yeah. That's right. First time caller line, Sharon is in San Antonio on Coast to Coast packing for Mars. With Mary Roach. Sharon?
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I just really am enjoying your show, and you're very entertaining and very knowledgeable and just really enjoying listening.
Thank you, Sharon.
And, I was just wondering, do you know anything as far as, like, how long it'll be before we can actually think about possibly colonizing or having some kind of station for Mars, or?
Yep.
Yeah. Well, it kind of depends on how we do it. The tricky part with Mars is getting back. I mean, we're pretty good at sending stuff to Mars, landers and rovers and such. And it's coming, getting the people back up off the surface and home. You know, you can't really carry all that fuel with you all the way there, and you know, you'd have to use some components of the atmosphere, and that's the stumbling block. But the way around that, what you could do, and it's a little radical, you could do essentially a one-way mission where you would
Right.
get astronauts who, and believe me, they are out there, astronauts who are A-okay with going there and not coming back. And not to say you're going to put them there and they'll starve and run out of oxygen. You would send up unmanned landers with what they need to survive and to build a habitat and to do science.
Right.
So, you know, that could be done relatively quickly. I mean, if you're talking about actually coming back, a round-trip mission, you know, we're talking 2040 at the earliest, and right now the space program is up in the air.
Right.
We don't even have a goal. We don't know where we're going. We don't know what we're doing.
I want to highlight her word colony, though, because I think that's one thing to talk about putting a scientific outpost up there like you would on Antarctica, but it's
right,
another
colony, to
colonize.
Right,
which
to have, you're talking about reproducing, having
right.
generations living there.
Bridges, schools, and roads. I mean, you're talking about, like,
the
full enchilada.
Not lifetime. Couple hundred years.
Really?
I don't know. I mean, that seems like,
It's been a long time since we colonized. I think, when was the last time we colonized something? Americans.
Foot fungus or something.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, let's think of how long it's been. We don't colonize nearly enough. I think we may have gotten rusty.
The lost art of colonization.
It is. It's the lost art of colonization. We used to do it all the time, but no.
It was fun. It was an adventure.
Exactly.
And, you know, Mars is easy because it's so, you know, the natives are so tiny. They're bacteria.
Right. That's right. But we could be talking about colonizing on the moon. I mean, part is you have to have a purpose, but right. That also happened.
Yeah, the moon base, they were talking up until last year, the Constellation program was a program to have a continuously inhabited base on the moon. And I think it would have been a while before anybody was going to be procreating and raising children there. I mean, that would have been, but, that I could have seen happening, like an Antarctic research base. I mean, there's still no children in Antarctica. It's a science base, but you could have people raising children there, conceiving children, and if that's the ultimate goal of the space program is to one day colonize another planet because our planet is dying, somebody ought to figure out, can you conceive in space? What's pregnancy like? What's the child? How does the child grow? I mean, those are all completely unanswered questions.
Because as of right now, as far as we know, nobody's actually done it in space, right?
As far as I've been able to find out, nobody's copping to it. Let's say that there are two flights, there are two missions that are come up over and over because one is a NASA mission where the shuttle mission, and they were involved and they got married without telling NASA, so they were newlyweds. Now, I'm sorry, if I was a newlywed and I was on the shuttle, I'd be in the airlock. But
yeah, you talk about the Mile High Club, right? I mean, this is where you win.
Exactly, the 200 Mile High Club.
You win every bar bet at that point.
I know.
But and the other was Jim Lovell and Frank Borman. Is that the other? Is that the other one? Back to Gemini.
Yeah, I'll give you Jim's phone number. You ask him.
Yeah. Let's go to Bill, West Hartford, Connecticut, for Mary Roach, packing for Mars. Bill.
Yes. Hi, Mary. Hi. Hi, Mary. I'm an amateur astronomer, so I understand tremendously space and astronomy. I wanted to ask you about the Mars Society, of which I'm a member of. And Dr. Robert Zubrin, head of that group, has said that we do not have to wait for technology that's over the horizon, such as the Vladimir engine of Dr. Franklin Chang Diaz or nuclear rocket engines. Uh-huh. He thinks that chemical rockets the size of the Saturn V rocket or larger, such as the heavy lift rockets that Congress has in the process of finalizing now with Barack Obama signing, and enough of those could send astronauts to Mars and back. What are your thoughts about new technologies and propulsion going to Mars versus chemical rockets?
Well, the rocket science is, again, I was more focusing on the human side of things, but I think that what's that ion propulsion that they talk about that would be able to do the trip in 29 days instead of, have you heard that?
Oh, I already put him on hold, but so, yes, oh, I'm sorry. But well, that's the kind of thing
anyway,
they're talking about?
In terms of the, there's a lot of talk about this cosmic radiation that would be a fairly sizable dose. There's bone loss and muscle wasting. There's things that go on, and you wouldn't have to deal with that if you had some form of propulsion that would get you there a lot faster. But as Bill was pointing out, that's stalling things and taking us way out into the future, and we could do it. Yeah, you could do it with existing technology. It's just a little harder to perhaps get the support, or people are uncomfortable with some of the human aspects, the radiation. But I think Bob Zubrin would say that is overestimated. That it's not as. I mean, there's debate as to how much of an issue that really will turn out to be.
Roy is in Reading, Pennsylvania, for Mary Roach on Coast to Coast. Roy?
Hello, Ian. Hello, Mary. You've kind of touched on a subject that I wanted to touch on is, has there been any research of sex in space? I can think of several problems with it, especially afterwards when all that stuff is floating around,
Well, it depends what you're doing, then.
I'm glad you asked, Roy.
Yes. This is right in her wheelhouse. Go ahead.
There have been some wonderful hoaxes and rumors that have gone around the internet that just were delightful. One of them as one of them claiming that there was an actual shuttle mission where astronauts tried out a dozen different positions to see which ones would work best, obviously. Can you imagine the government funding going to that? But to answer your question, there hasn't been any formal research in how to copulate in space best. I think really just use your imagination. It's just so many different positions possible, I would think.
Well, they have to come up with a new suit. We'd have to come like a suit for two kind of a thing, wouldn't they?
There is something called a snuggle tunnel that somebody invented.
Shut up.
Yeah. It's a
snuggle tunnel.
With zero gravity. See, gravity is your friend when it comes to intercourse, missionary position, let's say. You know, you do want something to be, you need to push against something. Otherwise, you kind of come apart. And I interviewed marine mammal biologists, about otters and dolphins,
right,
and creatures that have trouble staying together. And they tend to go down to the bottom, or they, grab the female rather uncomfortably because they drift apart. And so really, as one astronaut, I did find one astronaut, a lovely man who was willing to talk about this, and he said, really, not a big deal. If all else fails, a roll of duct tape.
Duct tape.
but there has been research on with rats on pregnancy, and so there were some rats that were up in zero gravity for the duration of the pregnancy, came down and gave birth, and there were some differences there. There's a whole bunch of questions about conception and about, would the egg travel the fallopian tube in the same way? Would implantation happen? What happens to sperm? Sperm have been up in space. Bull sperm have been up there riding around.
Have they?
They have.
They just brought it up there just to examine what happens to it?
Well, they were doing tests on it to see. There was a motility test. There was somebody looking at an enzyme which went a bit awry. So there's questions there. And these, like I was saying before, these are questions you would eventually want to answer if colonization is your
right. Well, no, we don't do it enough. We can. Marshall is in Yellow Springs, Ohio. Marshall.
Hi, how you doing?
Hey, Marshall.
Hi. Two things. One on the education side, and one on this whole Mars thing. Because it happens that this is what happens on the top STEM professional in the country for National Lab Day. I don't know if you've heard of that before, but it's an effort to connect scientists and engineers with students and around schools in the country to do STEM projects. And so to answer Ian's question about the purpose of do we really need more science? That the easy, quick answer is yes, because you never know who you're going to inspire to be the next Einstein or someone like that. See what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, it's really important that we do try to get as science literate as possible. It doesn't mean that every junior high school kid has to master quantum mechanics, but we definitely need to keep pace with the rest of the world because we are in a global society. And
well, can I just make the point here,
sure,
and say Einstein was German, right?
Yeah, right.
I mean,
exactly.
I mean, so we may have the next Einstein. If we do, it probably won't be here.
Well,
if
we have the next Einstein, and by we, I mean the United States, see what I'm saying? He'll be an American. He won't be German.
Well, I get
that. The other thing about it, and it's
going to be a Dane.
but the other thing about it is on the Mars thing, I also happen to be a member of the Mars Society and presented a paper on technokinetic solutions to long manned space missions, and basically what I ended up with was
I have a suspicion that we won't get the rest of the question in before the top of the hour, Marshall, so I'm going to cut bait here, but thank you. I wish we had more time for that, but what we do have is time to say goodbye to Mary Roach. Wishing you a happy holiday season, you and your family, Mary.
Thank you. You too, Ian. A pleasure, and to all the listeners too, happy holidays, and thanks for listening, and Ian, you're fabulous.
Oh, you're very sweet. So look forward to having people hook up with Mary and her books. Go to coasttocoastam.com. Great gift giving. So much fun reading and great inspiration, I think, to a lot of young kids out there. Hypnotism, what it can do for you in the new year, next on Coast to Coast.